Fellow fiends, welcome to another episode of Creepy Cases and Spooky Spaces. I am your host, Cassiopeia. You can catch me every Friday with brand new episodes of the creepiest and spookiest content. And if you subscribe to the Patreon or the Anchor pages, which you can do for as little as $5 a month, you get bonus content every other Tuesday. You get bonus content on the Patreon. You get a merchandise discount that's good for anything in the Wiccan Fae shop, including the candles and the Creepy Cases and Spooky Spaces merchandise. You also get a Creepy Case swag box, and the items in there kind of depend on which level you go with. Also, best of all, you get my love and appreciation. If you'd like to support without actually subscribing to the podcast, there is a Cash App and a Venmo set up. I'll go ahead and throw that up on the screen. Also, liking, sharing posts, commenting, tagging people, following on social media, all those things that we do on an absolute daily basis help get the podcast seen as well, helps with that algorithm that nobody can figure out and constantly changes on us day by day. But yeah, just that's how you can support there. You can buy merchandise from the Wiccan Fae shop at pizzaandpigtails.com. You can also buy candles, which has the Spooky Spaces, the Creepy Cases and Spooky Spaces line, which I will be adding to pretty soon, so keep an eye out for that. If you would like to put your own content, I do have ad space available with budget-friendly packages, so email me at creepycases.spookyspaces@gmail.com and I'll get those over to you. And without further ado, let's get started on today's case. Now, today's case that I have for you is actually a tragic and rather unsettling one, and it has spanned over the past 22 years. It's every parent's nightmare to lose a child, and what adds to that grief is when a child goes missing without a trace, never to be seen again. Living with the question of what happened is always present. Are they okay? Were they taken? Have they been harmed? Were they just unhappy and ran away and they're living their life somewhere else? So getting no closure is a large weight to carry around. Now, this is what happened to Sarah Turney, and she's been living with this since 2001. Now, Sarah didn't lose a child, but she did lose her sister, Alyssa, when she disappeared from their Phoenix, Arizona home. Now, at first, it seemed Alyssa just got fed up with her home life and ran away. But Sarah began seeing things as she got older that made her feel like her father played a much bigger role than he claims. Now, as I stated, for the past 22 years, Sarah, along with her brothers, has been Alyssa's biggest advocate and has been exhausting every route that she can. And when a suspect was taken into custody and charged in 2020, it seemed as though they would get their day in court. But it didn't play out quite the way they had hoped. So join me now, grab your poison, as I tell you about the creepy case of Alyssa Turney. Now, Alyssa Turney was born April 3rd, 1984. She lived in Phoenix with her mother, Barbara Farner, and her father, Stephen Strom. She had one older brother, and after her father left, her mother remarried in 1987, blending their family with Michael Turney, who had three sons of his own. A few years later, they welcomed Sarah. Sadly, in 1993, Barbara passed away from lung cancer, so Michael legally adopted Alyssa and raised the two girls on his own. Now, in 2001, Alyssa was your typical 17-year-old. She was an average student. She had a boyfriend. She had a part-time job at Jack in the Box, along with dreams of getting out of her hometown. She loved to draw, had an incredible smile, and she was super social. Now, by this time, her older brothers had moved out of the home, so it was just Alyssa, Sarah, and their father. Now, according to neighbors, friends, and even family members, it seemed Michael had a completely different relationship with each daughter. With Sarah, he was the cool, laid-back dad who let her do just about anything she wanted and gave her all that she asked for. But with Alyssa, tension ran pretty high. He was strict, uptight, and kept an oddly close eye on her. Borderline obsessive, if you ask me. He monitored her phone calls, which I think is creepy. I don't care who you are, but if you're listening in on anybody's like phone calls or keeping a close eye on them with cameras, I find that to be just mental. Like, that's psychotic to me. He had home surveillance, even hidden cameras in the air vents, and would watch Alyssa at work with binoculars and sometimes even film her. He wanted complete control over her for some reason. He even created these homemade handwritten agreements with Alyssa, which were pretty creepy. And I'm not sure if they were even like legal, because they stated things that Alyssa agreed to do and not to do until she turned 18. And there was also one that stated he never tried to molest her, which, I mean, that sounds like something somebody who tried to molest someone would create. Not gonna lie. Michael told Sarah that he was this way with Alyssa because she needed more guidance and direction in life, that she was too easily swayed and could fall in with the wrong crowd. They constantly yelled at each other, and a teen's occasional discontent with authority isn't really alarming or uncommon. I think we've all at one point hit that time in our lives where we just wanted to be free. We wanted to just kind of do what we wanted to do, and we didn't want somebody over our shoulder the whole time. Guilty. Now, Alyssa wasn't the only one who had an issue with her living arrangements. James Turney, one of Michael's sons, actually told NBC News he had hoped to bring Sarah and Alyssa to live with him when their mother passed away, but this didn't play out. Now, Katie Rothweiler, a school friend of Alyssa, said she was a completely different person when she was with her friends as opposed to when she was with her family. With her friends, she radiated energy. She was outgoing. She was bright. She smiled all the time. But with her family, it seemed that energy was just sucked back in. And so when she went missing, suspicion quickly turned to Michael. It was May 17th, 2001. It was the last day of school. Alyssa poked her head into her boyfriend John's class at Paradise Valley High School and told him that her stepfather, Michael, was taking her out of school early. And John states that this was the last time he would see Alyssa. Now, Michael admitted to, yes, he picked up Alyssa early so he could take her to lunch to celebrate the end of her junior year. But he claims that they got into an argument after she told him that she wanted more freedom. And Michael told her, as long as you live under my roof, you're going to check in with Daddy, because Daddy is a nervous wreck if you don't. Now, I totally understand if you're living under my roof, you're going to live by my rules. But that's one of the creepiest ways you can word that. Like, this is a 17-year-old. You're no longer Daddy. You are Dad. And that's if she even called you Dad growing up. She might have, but you also might just be Michael to her, especially with the way that you seem to have been raising her. Now, he told police that he dropped her off at home around 1 p.m., claiming that she was angry, and she went straight to her room, and so he left to run errands, and that's the last time anybody had seen her. The 12-year-old Sarah was at an end-of-year retreat at Waterworld, where Michael was supposed to pick her up at 3 p.m. However, he never showed up, so Sarah walked to a friend's house where she called Michael to tell him that that's where she was and that she would just wait for him to come pick her up. Now, when he finally arrived later that evening, he told her that Alyssa was missing. He gave her his cell phone and told her to keep trying to call Alyssa because she wasn't answering the phone. Sarah also had no luck. She left multiple messages, called multiple times, but Alyssa never answered. Now, when they returned to the house, Sarah found Alyssa's room in disarray, which she claims was highly unusual for the teen. A note found that read, "Dad and Sarah, when you dropped me off at school today, I decided I really am going to California. Sarah, you said you really wanted me gone. Now you have it. Dad, I took $300 from you. That's why I saved my money." Sarah didn't think much of it at the time, but being 12 years old, a lot of what was going on may not have fully registered. And she told people, quote, "I wasn't worried. I was under the impression she was going to be back. I didn't think her being gone forever was anything that ever crossed my mind." And she added to Dateline, quote, "California was a beautiful dream that many people here wanted. She even wanted a white Jeep to drive around in, just like Cher in the movie Clueless." Now, Sarah also pointed out that they had an aunt in California who Alyssa had recently talked about going to live with, and her friends and siblings said that she was scared of Michael and unhappy with his overly strict rules, and she couldn't wait to get out on her own. Now, when Alyssa failed to show up for an end-of-the-year party that night, Michael, who used to be a deputy sheriff himself, called police and reported Alyssa as a runaway. A missing persons file was open, but no investigation was really done, and I'm sure that we're all shocked and amazed by that detail. Police basically wrote Alyssa off as a rebellious runaway, except all of her belongings, including all of her clothes, her cell phone, her makeup, other prized possessions that someone would definitely take with them if they were running away, were all left in her uncharacteristically messy room. Now, the $1,800 in her bank account was left untouched, and you would think that that would be one of the first things that she would take with her. Clearly. Now, at this time, investigators determined that there was no foul play. Her brother James said that he told Alyssa she could stay with him, but she never turned up there, nor did she turn up at her aunt's house. Sarah said her relationship with Alyssa was a very close one, and Alyssa was always warm and very protective of her, so she doesn't believe that she would have left her with Michael on her own, and if she did leave, she would at least tell Sarah, or she would have contacted her after the fact to let her know that she was okay, even if she didn't disclose her whereabouts. So Sarah definitely knew that something just wasn't right. Now, Michael Turney told 2020 he was frustrated because he felt the Phoenix Police Department was doing nothing, so he printed up flyers and began posting them around town while he did his own detective work. About a week after Alyssa disappeared, Michael told police that he received a garbled phone call from someone he believed was Alyssa between 4 and 5 a.m. from Riverside, California. He said that she told him she was very unhappy with her life at home and he was the reason that she left, cursed at him, and hung up. Now, Michael claims that he went to Riverside to look for her, but no one claims having seen her. This call also was never confirmed by police or investigators, as it was never traced. There's no record of the call. And conveniently enough, that recording system that Michael had set up that was basically recording everything, that like all of the calls in the house, was turned off due to the early hour. So it kind of put a crack in that clue's integrity. Now, if I was a crazy person who had my entire house filled to the nines with cameras and a recording system and this, that, and the other, I think that that time would be like when I would have the recording system turned on, because that's just that time where if somebody's calling me and harassing me or calling me at all with emergency, I want proof of that. Now, over the next few years, Michael would go on to exhibit some questionable behavior that would bring even more suspicion his way. He made inappropriate comments about Alyssa and her disappearance. He never reached out to any of her friends or family to follow up on if she had turned up at their place or if she was hiding out somewhere. He knew that the money from her bank account was never touched, and somehow knew that her social security number hadn't been used either. So she never went to school or got a job anywhere, which if you're out living your best life somewhere, you know you're going to need a job at some point. Now, he probably knew this because he did it, but he also spoke of these elaborate and bizarre conspiracy theories involving government agencies and law enforcement, causing the mystery to the case to deepen even more. Now, in 2006, the case went from presumed runaway to possible homicide when a convicted murderer who was actually in prison, Thomas Heimer, he's a self-proclaimed serial killer, by the way, he confessed to killing Alyssa and stealing her car in Georgia. Now, this obviously was found to be false, mostly because the description he gave to police didn't fit Alyssa's description, but it did lead to two Phoenix detectives, William Anderson and Stuart Summershoe, to take a closer look at the case. Now, they both explained that they found a lot of red flags, mostly the fact in cases like this where someone is trying to run away from an abusive situation, they don't leave a note on where they're going because they don't want to be found. They also tend not to contact the person that they're running away from to tell them that they weren't happy and they're the reason they ran away, especially because if he was recording everything and he did have some kind of tracer or did have some kind of caller ID, which I'm sure he did at that time because who didn't, you don't want that kind of information getting back to the person you ran away from. Now, they interviewed 200 friends, family members, teachers, classmates, co-workers, and they found out some alarming details. Now, every one of these people said that Alyssa had confided that Michael tried to molest her on more than one occasion. It was said that Alyssa told multiple people that when she was younger, he had picked her up early from school, seemed to be a trend, drove her out to a secluded area and tried to, quote, fool around with her. Now, another time, she actually says that she had woken up tied to a chair with Michael on top of her trying to gag her. The question contracts between the two, they found some disturbing things in there as well. Not only was it do's and don'ts until she was 18, but they were very explicit in sexual do's and don'ts. Now, Sarah actually created a website to keep everyone updated on the case. And this was kind of when she first started speaking out for Alyssa and trying to get her case looked at and solved. Now, in 2008, she was actually called down to the police station and told that her house was going to be raided or searched. Police found all of the surveillance films, home videos, dating back years to when the girls were actually little. And once again, very conveniently, the day that Alyssa went missing, there's no footage. The cameras either weren't working or they were turned off or there was no footage that day. But they were also surprised to find 30 explosive devices, 19 high caliber assault rifles, 2 handmade silencers, and a 98-page manifesto titled Diary of a Madman Martyr. Madman Martyr. This dude is crazy. Now, in this manifesto, Michael actually writes that he had planned an attack on the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Union in Phoenix. He said that he worked for them at one point in time, and he was a whistleblower. And as revenge on him, they abducted Alyssa and murdered her. So he was just trying to get avenge her death when he murdered 2 of them. Just a side note, both of the men who he claims to have murdered died of natural causes. So he was arrested on charges for the bombs and all the weapons. He served 10 years and he was released in 2017. He was also diagnosed with paranoid personality disorder and forced to participate in treatments. He has held on to his innocence and denies ever sexually assaulting Alyssa or abducting her or murdering her. Now, in 2019, Sarah turned to social media to get her sister's case even more attention. And we all know the true crime community is ruthless when it comes to pushing for a case to be looked at or solved or to get any kind of movement. Now, she started a podcast named Voices for Justice, which actually had over 1 million followers. And it focused on her sister's disappearance and her father's suspicious behavior. Now, she posted videos on TikTok to expose him as a rapist and a murderer, and she stated that looking back, quote, the relationship our father had with Alyssa is commonly described by those who knew her as one closer to an abusive boyfriend rather than a fatherly figure, end quote. She also stated that this is not going away. I'm going to make sure it never does, to Dateline. Now, Sarah obtained the files on the case and went through all 3,000 pages within 6 weeks. And she claims that at first, she actually felt compelled to kind of help Michael because he's her father. And he was always so kind and generous to her, but she was convinced that he was responsible and she knew that she couldn't let him get away with it. Now, she was told that after his release, police would be arresting him for Alyssa's murder, but sadly, nothing happened, so she pushed a little more. She posted videos of him verbally abusing Alyssa and showed just how frightened she was of him. And in one of the videos, you can actually hear Alyssa in the background saying, "Dad's a pervert. Hey, Sarah, Dad's a pervert." I just don't understand it's right there. The evidence is right there. Sarah also posted blog posts with titles like 5 Reasons I Know My Father Killed Alyssa Turney. Now, when Sarah asked Michael outright if he killed Alyssa, he told her, "Be there at my deathbed and I'll give you all the honest answers you want to hear." Now, Sarah then asked him, "Why don't you give them to me now?" And Michael replied, "Because you've got them now." He also said that he would admit to what he did if police agreed to give him lethal injection within 10 days. Now, if that's not basically a confession, come on, how much more do you need? Like, I don't know what is if you don't consider that a confession. Now, on August 20th, 2020, Michael Turney, was finally arrested and charged with second-degree murder in Alyssa's case. Now, his neighbors all said that they weren't surprised. I don't see how anybody could be. They were always uncomfortable around him. They even said that they felt like he was watching them as well. And one actually referred to him as their psycho neighbor and refused to let him anywhere near her kids. I don't blame you. However, in July 2023, Michael Turney had his day in court, but it wasn't quite the outcome that anyone expected. After 5 days of testimony from multiple people, such as Sarah Turney, William Anderson, Stuart Summershoe, and even John Lakeman, Alyssa's boyfriend at the time, Michael was acquitted. Now, this is where the law kind of sucks, in my opinion, because we all know, like, by this point, with the things that he did and the things that he said and just the way that he was acting, and where was he? Why didn't he show up on time to pick Sarah up? Like, why did he show up later that evening? What was he doing? His lawyers, Jamie Jackson and Olivia Hicks, which I know that they're just doing their job, but and as much as like I would love to go into law and be in law somehow, I don't think I could ever be a defense attorney, because if I know that you're guilty, job or not, I cannot get you off of whatever you did. And I, like I said, I know that they were just doing their job, and I don't hold anything against them, obviously, but I just don't think I could get people who are guilty off, especially for murder, you know. So they motioned for an acquittal due to Rule 20 in the Phoenix laws of something, that there was no substantial evidence that Michael killed Alyssa. I mean, honestly, I get it. There's no body. There was no crime scene. There's no proof to say that anything did happen. I think we all know he did it. That's all I can really say. But the charges were dropped and Michael was released July 18th to live out the rest of his days in what I hope is a rather miserable and uncomfortable existence. I usually try my best not to wish bad on people. However, this case, I think, is justified. Now, Sarah and her brothers thanked everyone for their support throughout the years. Their followers, the crime community, Phoenix Police Department, and the nonprofit organization Defenders of Children, stating an apology to Alyssa and saying that while they don't agree with the ruling, they respect it as it's the law. But I think the saddest part of this whole case is that even if Alyssa's body is found, they can't try Michael Turney again. And I think we can all agree, and I'm pretty sure they know as well, that they had their guy. And they know they had their guy. And sadly, due to the law, he got away with it. So on that note, I will say, until next crime. Creepy Cases and Spooky Spaces with Cassiopeia is a Pizza and Pigtails production. All episodes are researched, written, and edited by yours truly. You can find new episodes every Friday, with bonus episodes coming out every other Tuesday. You can find the podcast on your favorite listening platform, or now you can find it on YouTube as well. Don't forget to follow along on social media, creepycases.spookyspaces, for all future news, updates, and maybe some content that you won't find on the podcast. Also, be sure to subscribe so you can get access to bonus content, early access to content, and a couple of little thank you swag. If you'd like to contact me about appearing on a future episode, maybe you would would like to suggest your own creepy case or spooky space, or maybe you'd also like to reach out about ad space, you can reach me directly at creepycases.spookyspaces@gmail.com, or feel free to reach out through those social media platforms as well. And as always, see you next crime.